interviewing Mr. Otis Lawrence at 470 Ferry in Pontiac, March 9th, 1977. Mr. Lawrence, when did you come to Pontiac and where did you come from?
I came to Pontiac from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in the year of 1945, the month of November. And since that time, I've been engaged in the labor movement, Democratic Party, organizational work, Boy Scouts, Urban League, United Fund, participated in the first FEPC city ordinance within the city of Pontiac. Also, scoutmaster of the first interracial Boy Scout troop, Troop 14, in the city of Pontiac.
Why did you come to Pontiac?
I came here due to employment. Maybe better cut it. Hold it there. Then I came to Pontiac due to the fact that fighting for a better place in which to work and a better place in which to live, I had somewhat of a problem controlling my hands, and in so doing, I got in several fights, lost my job, and in the meantime, working for the Clairton Steel Works, or the U.S. Steel Company, at Clairton, Pennsylvania, after getting into a fight, they then told me they were going to send me to the Army. So my wife happened to look into the newspaper, and they were wanting qualified coal miners. So I then applied for a job in the coal mine. I was hired. And so I was frozen to my job until the war was over. So when the war was over, I then left Pittsburgh, came to Pontiac, as I had a brother-in-law living here in Pontiac. And I started to work at Wilson Foundry and Machine Company. I worked there until I became eligible to run for office, which I had union background coming into Pontiac, and I then ran for committeeman at Wilson Foundry, won committeeman, and after winning committeeman, I was then elected as president of the local union, the first black to be elected president of a local union in the city of Pontiac and also in the state of Michigan, under UAW. So from that point, I became active in all programs, all civic organizations relative to making this place or this city or community a better place in which to live.
What kind of work did you do at Wilson Foundry?
I worked in the core room. Prior to that, I worked in the foundry. And this type of work was really dirty, hard. I didn't have any question with that, but Wilson Foundry had a system. All the black worked in the foundry, all the white in the core room and in the machine shop. So I worked in the foundry 3 months, long enough to acquire seniority. So I go to my foreman and I told him I wanted to work somewhere else in the plant. I didn't want to quit and I wasn't going to work out there any longer. So he wouldn't grant me permission, so I left my job and I go on to the front office. And in the meantime, I purchased a newspaper and I asked to see the president of the company. And they first refused me, but I insisted, so they did grant me permission. So I go into his office and I use the newspapers to sit on rather than to dirty up his office. And I put my request before him. So he called the superintendent of the courtroom. And I told him I had never worked in a courtroom or what have you, but I wasn't going to work in a foundry. And so they gave me a job in the courtroom. And then I learned the whole system of operating the courtroom. So then I became the title of the job right of the moment. I became the first special assistant. No, I became the assistant specialist in the courtroom. And I burnt midnight oil in order to learn the courtroom system. And so from that, I participated in all activities, elected a committee to work with me within the local union, and we began to hire black all over the plant and hired black women. And the first black woman that we hired was Johnny McCallum, the woman that has this night spot. I forget what she calls her place. Johnny McCallum was the first lady. So I go to her and sit down and talk with her and brief her on how to meet some of the conditions that she was going to run into, some of the problems in working with the white. And in the meantime, I had checked with several of the white ladies working in the plant. About half said they had no objection working with black, and the other half, they were doubtful or they didn't want to work with no colored. And they hadn't been used to it, and they just wasn't going to do it. So I told them to put forth their best effort, and I was quite sure that they could make it. And certainly under the UAW banner, it was up to them. Either work with them, or I would see, not a threat, but I would see that the no discrimination clause within the contract would be adhered to. And it was either they make up their mind to work with black or they would be discharged in violation of the Constitution and the contract. And so the first colored girl was hired, Johnny McCallum. And she did a terrific job. She really was cooperative. And so we hired several colored or black girls from there on out and integrated the whole plant. And it became a working plant. And when I was elected, I made definitely sure that I had a integrated board and integrated committees and everything throughout the plant. And we had one of the best locals within the UAW.
When were you elected to the position? And what?
1950.
1950. Mm-hmm. And what was the name of that position again?
President of the, the first time I was elected was in 1946, and that was committeeman.
And when was Mrs. Campbell hired?
She was hired in, I think it was in 47.
Now, when you made the move to get her hired,
mm-hmm.
was this was with the blessing of the union, or what had the, I guess I should ask that first. This
mm-hmm.
was with the blessing of the union. You were moving, doing
mm-hmm.
these things in the name of the union?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Okay. Now, what kind of activities in this area, the whole area of hiring blacks into positions that they normally did not hold, you know, you said they were all in the foundry primarily.
Mm-hmm.
What efforts had been made on the part of the union prior to this to try to address that situation?
They wouldn't approach it.
Why not?
We had, at that time, it was a white president, and we had three black committeemen who were complacent, didn't want to disturb the program. The company had never hired. They had never been approached on it. And I asked these questions when I first got there, and so they told me it couldn't be done. And I told them, oh yes, I think it could be done. And so I had more black fighting me than I did white, because they had laid down on the job, had never approached it, were real satisfied with the way that things were going, and conditions were bad, were really bad. And so I pushed and got the group in behind me that were favorable to my thinking as it related to right and promoting fairness and job opportunity to all. And so that was the effort we put forth.
I gather then that you were not in Pontiac when the whole union movement took place in the plants here. Is that right or wrong? Were you here at that time? When did that take place, I guess?
That taken place in 1936. The union was organized. I came in here with and helped organize, and just a young fella, in 1935, and came in with John L. Lewis, and I grew up within the labor movement. My dad helped, was very active within the union, held positions in the union, and he and John L. Lewis were very close. They hoboed Illinois together. And so I had it in my system, and then on the organizing in Detroit, I participated in that. I participated in organizing in Pontiac in 35 and 36, and also in Flint. And this is at the time that you had to be a pretty good Dukesman, you know, in order to keep the people from going over the picket line. So you kept some from going, some went over. You know, you couldn't whip everybody.
Can you describe those organizing activities in Pontiac? Give me some background on that. What actually happened? How did you do that?
It was rough. We had to fight. We had to fight in order to hold the people back out of the plant, talk to them, and they were getting 35 cents an hour. At this time, conditions were bad. Either you work 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours, whatever the foreman wants you to work. No overtime and nothing, just 35 cents an hour. If you didn't do it, it was a line standing out in front, ready to come in. So overtime, no overtime. On Saturdays or Sundays, you had to work. If the foreman wanted your wife to fix a steak, you fix it. These are some of the conditions. This is what we were fighting for. And your child, if you wanted to put him to work, you could lie about his age, you could put him to work if you were in good with the foreman. Conditions were really bad. And slaveryism within the automotive industry, this is what we had. And so in order to correct that, that was why we were fighting for the union, to get something concrete and in black and white where we'd have some system to work under, and rather than to be driven like a bunch of cattle. And this is what was happening.
What was generally the feeling in the black community about unions at the time you
Well,
organized?
At that time, they didn't know. And see, the black man was the last one to come in to the union. And they used him as a union breaker. He was a great guy when they wanted the union. So they would up his earnings. And so he knew no better. And then the thing of it, after we got the union, then we had the problem with the white discriminating against the black, and the company discriminating. They would give the white 5 or 10 cents more per hour than the Negro. And so this caused the Negro to rebel too, you know. So it was a little bit rough at this time. And so we had to talk to them. We had a lot of ignorance. The boss would tell him one thing, come to his house, do him little favors and so forth. So this kept him satisfied. He was all right with the boss. And what we were telling him, it just didn't seem like it was going to be reality, you know. And so we had a problem with the black in trying to organize. So he was used to break the strike. And after we got organized and through educational programs, then he became a strong union man and began to see what he could do for himself in participating and being a part.
Prior to the organization of the unions, what was the percentage of blacks who were employed in the plants?
Very low. All he could do was sweep the floor. A janitorial work and work of that nature. Machines and nothing, he didn't operate that. And we had quite a time after we got the union organized to get him promoted into those fields. And incidentally, after I became president, Wilson Foundry was the first plant to have Negro skill. And then I go into Pontiac plant and help break it down there to get black into machine repair, millwright, and so forth. And Angelo White was the first black skilled tradesman to work at Pontiac Motor. I was then on the staff of the UAW, and we had to specifically lay the rule down that if they walked out, they were going to walk out. If they walked out, they would be blackballed from the union.
I mean, the whites mm-hmm. were working in that particular
yeah.
area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this, if it's my memory serves me right, this is around about 1948. Yeah.
Okay. Now, In looking at this whole period of time, we know that there was a great influx of people, all kinds of people, particularly black individuals, who were coming into this area to find employment. What is your impression of what brought most of the people here? You know, where'd they come from? What did they find in the way of employment after they got here? How did you have, what is your perception of the movement of people from southern areas, particularly, into this area? How did people get here? Why did they come here?
They used a system of, they went through the South, and they used a transportation system. That you come to Pontiac, you would be hired, you would receive a job, and your fare was paid and everything. So this is the way most of them came here, was on this transportation setup. Came into Pontiac, they had what you call a trailer camp. Federally houses trailer camp that was set up. And this is the way most of the people came into Pontiac and were given a job, and particularly at Wilson Foundry. That's what they wanted, people in the foundry, and the wages were down somewhat low, but they had gotten a union, but hadn't gotten the wages up to where they should have been. And so at Pontiac Motor, they did the same thing. So this is the way most of the black and most of the white, since the World War II, I believe, wasn't it? World War II? Yeah. Got to Pontiac.
Do you know of individuals who were actually paid? Do you personally know individuals who were had their way paid up?
My brother-in-law, one, Harry Ricks.
Where did he come from?
Centralia, Illinois. And several from Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, all through the South. And it's mostly from Illinois on down south. And just any number of people, people who have retired as of this date, and who are much older than I am. I'm 69. So it's in any number of people that witnessed this transition.
What was I'm not quite clear of what the relationship of Wilson Foundry was to the automotive industry. Was that part of it, or was it part of GM?
Was a foundry, and what they did, Wilson Foundry made motor blocks. That's the engine. Or various companies, like General Motors. They made some motor blocks for General Motors, some for Chrysler, some for American Motors, Packard, and so forth. So it was somewhat of a supplier, what they call a supplier plant. Whatever they wanted, Wilson Foundry made it. That's in the form of motor blocks, bell housing, crankshafts, and all parts of a mortar. They made it at Wilson. That was a foundry. So that was the tie-in as it relates to the automotive industry. And that eventually, you might be familiar with Kaiser Frazier. It was then bought out by Willis Overland and Kaiser Frazier, Wilson Foundry was. And then it finally went out of business.
Okay. It was a separate part. It was a separate entity then from the automotive industry, although it supplied them with the...
Right. It was a supplier plant. Okay. Foundry, rather.
Okay. Now, tell me, let's see, what was the relationship then with the automotive plants that were here, right? GM was here, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
The Pontiac plant, I guess, was...
GM Truck and Coach,
yes.
Fisher Body, and Pontiac Motors were here.
What was the relationship of black workers within those companies?
Wasn't too good there either. Wasn't too good. There's quite a few black working at Pontiac, and none working on skilled jobs, you know, just common labor, and mostly sweepers. Quite a few women, you know, and all the women could do was sweep and take care of the restrooms and stuff like that. And GM, General Motors and Truck, they were very discriminatory, still are. Have to work on this one year in and year out. And we've had some promotion of black foremen who become carried away, you know. You rub my back, you know, and I don't know where this should go on here or not. Erase that. So, you know, some problems there, you know. And they forget from where they came and how they came and where they're going, you know. So.
What was the nature of the discrimination there at this point in time?
Well, the on hiring, there were certain jobs you were hired for. And certain jobs, you could request, but you would never get on them, you know. And it was always someone else wanted the job. And based on seniority, you were entitled to a job based on seniority with qualifications or the opportunity of learning the job. But seniority was disregarded. And some of our committeemen, particularly white, would go along with the foreman on this, with the company on this. So we had a fight there. Then we had problems getting black committeemen elected due to the area in which they were working. It was more white than it was colored or black, and it was hard for them to get elected. And then when one did get elected, why, a little afraid to speak up, you know. So we had that problem and still have it.
When you had those problems, what steps or what was the role of the union headquarters? We're talking about the UAW at this
mm-hmm.
point, that's right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What was the stance that was taken by the leadership within the UAW?
They did not support
vis-a-vis those roles?
They did not support it. And they were bitterly against it. But regardless of how they disagreed, they were not in the plant. And it was up to the representation within the plant to do it. Many meetings were held. Discuss with them, ask them to write grievances, take positions, and so forth. And it was hard to get them to do it. Even today, we have some problems. And it's a buddy-buddy deal, you know. And you make it nice for me, and we have a problem now where some of our committeemen, they can come in late, they can do a little boozing and so forth, and boss looks it over, they trade grievances, and this type of thing. So it's a continued pressure put on the international in trying to correct these things, you know.
What exactly did they do to try to correct it? I guess I'm trying to get a handle on that. Did you have people coming out from the headquarters to the local?
Yeah. And we would meet with them. We would meet with them, discuss with them, talk to them, and held classes to let them know just what their position was, how they should go about different things, and so forth. So it was not the lack of knowledge. It was the lack of playing politics, you know, in order to get elected. And so the foreman, if he liked the committeeman, he could get by with just about anything, and he could do favors for his people, you know, whoever his supporters were. And if you were not a supporter of the committeeman, many times, we've about broken this up now, if you were a buddy to the committeeman, you were all right, you know, you could get by. And so some of this has been corrected, and it's a day in and day out job constantly, trying to get good representation elected.
On this business of seniority, how did that work in the plants? Did they have, at this point in time, did they have plant-wide seniority, or was it departmental seniority?
It was departmental seniority within a department. And then in contract negotiations, we got it on a plant-wide basis. This was for in the event that your job went down in an area where you were working or department, then you would have the opportunity of plant-wide seniority, what they call bumping or transferring into a different job rather than to be laid off. And then that way the youngest person would be laid off.
This would also include skilled as well as unskilled categories?
Yeah, yeah. But the skill would be within the skill. See, production within production. Because you couldn't take out of production, put in the skill in that case. So it'd have to be within production and within skill. See.
Okay, now, I guess the problem that would always, that usually came about at that point was that most blacks were concentrated in the unskilled categories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there were very few in skilled categories.
Mm-hmm.
What was the plan of action or the course of action to make sure that plans put into play to get more blacks into skilled positions? What was done?
All right, we had to set up skilled trades programs and on various jobs and training, and we had the upgrading system, skilled trades upgrading system, in order to train them into the job. And they had to work as a journeyman trainee, and they were trained to the job and went into the system based on an upgrader. And then as an upgrader, they had to work so many hours as an upgrader, and then after putting in so many hours, then they became eligible to become a journeyman. And after becoming a journeyman, they were issued a card as a skilled tradesman. So they were given the same opportunity that all other employees had been given over the years. And this started roughly in 47 and 48 is when this started. Now, the other thing that prohibited many blacks from going into skilled trades, in order to participate in a skilled trades conference or convention, you had to be a president of a local union. So we didn't have any blacks, and I was one of the first that participated in the skilled trades meetings, conferences, and conventions. and I used to take the floor. Used to get a lot of head colds and everything, and standing up. I stood alone, but I stood. One or two whippings, but I did all right. So, a little rough sailing.
Were you involved in the, well, I'm going to go back now, but mm-hmm. were you involved in the, that final unionization of Ford in Detroit in the late 1930s?
Yeah,
Can you describe that whole experience, what happened?
Pretty nasty. That's at the Ford overpass, and we were trying to permit the people from going in. We had the Bennett gang there, police, and they turned the dogs, horses loose on us. Horse would come up and paw, throw tear gas at us. But we learned to catch the tear gas and throw it back on them, and it would explode. So there's a lot of bloodshed. A few got killed, and I got a whipping or two. And I was compensated.
Why was the unionizing effort at Ford so difficult?
The Bennett gang, Ford, this was the watchman and so forth that looked out after and bodyguards for Henry Ford. And incidentally, he was living then, Henry Ford. And they definitely didn't want the union. And they were definitely going to keep the union out. And that's when Walter Reuther, Roy Reuther, Victor Reuther, Emil Macy, Leonard Woodcock, and all of the top leaders now participate in this strike. And I have some pictures here. I'll show you some of the guys. And so that's a rough one. I hate to go back over that one. Then I organized in the coal mine, laid in a ditch for dead, you know. Guys come up and kick you, you know. So you just lay there like you were dead, not breathe, what have you. So it was rough. It was rough.
Now, what was the relationship of the, I gather that many elements of the black community were very much involved in that whole process of the organizing it forward.
Not too much.
Not the community?
Not too much. Yes, the community. But black participation, in fact, it was new. Wasn't too many black working in the plant. And realistically speaking, perhaps they wonder what advantage would it be for me. Maybe this was some of the reasons. I don't know. And so it wasn't too many out there in the front line battling.
Was there the perception that Ford was in fact the largest hirer of blacks at that point?
Right.
Mm-hmm. How did this play in that whole struggle within the black community of whether to unionize them or whether not to unionize them?
Well, with Ford talking, and he was paying the highest wages at that time, he was a godfather. So, do you want to lose this? This is what they were preaching. Or do you want the union? And they will take out your union dues. They will do this and they will do that. And when they got done preaching to them, and some of our black preachers, you know, preaching across the pulpit, he was getting his pocket grease, preaching across the pulpit, you know, this helped hurt our battle too.
Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about. It appeared that there was a coalition of ministers mm-hmm. there that figured mm-hmm. very prominently in that whole relationship
right,
with Ford.
Right.
What can you tell me some more about that? How they operated and.
Well, they received donations. It is our belief, and we do know that they were able to get whoever they wanted hired. Their membership, they could get them hired. And if the union came in, this would cut them off of some of their power, you know. So this was our problem. Then donations and so forth for the church, you know, they could get that. And they used the minister in the labor movement just like they did in slavery time, you know, the black minister. And this was their problem.
Was there a comparable situation in Pontiac?
Yes, same thing. Had same thing. We had the sit down strike here at Fisher Body, and the one in Flint, and some of the black that I know today had to fight them off to keep them from going in the plant. So I had the opportunity after the union got in to then talk with them and ask why, you know, but I had to fight some of them off. So they claimed they didn't know any better, that they had been talked to and they had been given money and so forth, and groceries sent to the house and so forth. So we could see that with this happening, you know, you would have some weak people, and it takes a strong person to stand up under this. A lot of times I went hungry, but I stood. And when you go to pulling with the belt around the waistline, you don't have too many strong standing up. So. It's a rough thing, you know. You go back over it. I wouldn't want to go over it again for nothing. Mm-hmm.
Why was there this reluctance to hire black women?
Well, first of all, the white women said that they would not work with them. They were nasty. They were filthy. And all they were supposed to do was work in the kitchen. They didn't have the intelligence to work in a plant. And if they hired, then they would have nobody to do domestic work and so forth. And incidentally, in the city of Pontiac, we had Birmingham protesting, because some of their help went into the plant. And then the women that did work, they upped the wages, so they had to pay them, see. So they were bitterly against. And this is where some of the big executives lived. So the executives were against it too. And they politely told us that their wife wouldn't have no one to do the housework, you know. So this is the setup. They didn't bite their tongue. Didn't bite their tongue. And many of the guys worked in the plant. Their wives worked out there. Their daughters, their sons, you know. So they had a thing going, and they didn't want to disturb that. And you'd have your meetings and work out your policy and everything. And before the meeting was over with, the people in Birmingham, or the top echelon executives, knew everything. So they had a good pipeline. So it was rough going.
So they actively fought to keep black women out of the plants,
right,
in order to keep them in the...
Right, in the domestic field, yeah. And so the only reason that they did hire them was because of shortage of men. So they had to hire them. Then with the union becoming active, after they were hired, they couldn't fire them. They tried this. After the war was over, they were going to fire them, but they couldn't. And we had to go before the Supreme Court, state and nationally, to uphold that right. They had accumulated seniority, and they therefore were entitled to a job. And then we had the weight problem, that they couldn't lift no more than 54 pounds, or they couldn't work no more than 54 hours, you know, within a week. So we had all of those labor laws and everything to fight against and to fight for.
What kind of other employment were blacks engaged in during that period of time? I don't have a feel for the percentage that was hired in the plants. Now, again, I know that, you know, you had all these people coming up
mm-hmm.
from outside of the city
mm-hmm.
Who came to work in plant situations. I don't know if the majority of them did work in the plant. If they did not, where they worked, what was the total employment picture like?
See, what you had here at that time, you had Fisher Body, you had GM Truck and Coach. GM Truck and Coach, that would be Local 594. Fisher Body would be Local 596. Pontiac Motor would be Local 653. Then you had Bald and Rubber. This is where they made rubber. You had Wilson Foundry. You had several foundries outlying on the outskirts of Pontiac. And then you had several little parts plants. This is where they made parts, like doorknobs and handles and stuff like that. All of this was on the outskirts of Pontiac. And then your domestic work and stuff like that, that's where you people worked. Within this area. And so it was full bloom at that time. See, Pontiac worked somewhere around about 24,000 people. That's Pontiac Motor. Fisher Body around about 12,000, and this plant over here around about 15. So they're down now about 5,000. That's this plant over here, and Fisher Body about 4,000. Pontiac somewhere around about 12,000. So they worked, and then Wilson Foundry at that time worked around about 4,000. And so that taken up the trucks of your people that were transported in. Then a lot of people came in on their own, you know, different ones riding back and telling them to come up, they could get them a job. And they could, and we had three and four families staying in one house.
In terms of that living situation, where did most of the blacks live?
They had a trailer camp, and then they had the public housing here that was specifically set up for the people coming into Pontiac. This was federally owned and built by the federal government for the specific purpose of hiring people who had came to Pontiac to work. And on that, when the war was over with and everything, then they were going to tear these down, and people had nowhere to go. So I formed a committee, and I got some letters there on it. I made a trip to Washington, wore out two pair of shoes, going around getting signatures and everything, and got them to hold the housing. And this is when the city commission was against me too. And they wanted to get rid of the people. And at the time we had one black commissioner on, I won't call his name, won't crucify him, on the commission. And they wanted to get rid of people, send them back wherever they came from, you know? And so the commission was against us, wanted to get rid of the housing. So we were able to fight it and got him to hold it until the people were able to move elsewhere. So we have some, I lived over there too. So we have people living all over, and they have nice homes now.
Were blacks generally able to buy housing anywhere in the city?
You couldn't,
not
then. You couldn't. Uh-uh. There's no houses for you to buy. And so then we began to work on that one. And this is when that law was passed, you know, where you had the opportunity of living anywhere where you were able to buy. And I participated in that. So along with other people in cooperation, and I had plenty of cooperation. I didn't do it all by myself, but I did have the nerve to stand up, you know? So I was able to get, I had my neck out like this a lot of times. But I was able to get others to stick with me too, you know. And so together we did a good job.
What was the relationship of the people who came during the 40s, like yourself, and the blacks who had been living here prior to 1940? The community that was already here. What was the relationship between those two groups?
Well, we were newcomers. See, the old vet, I call them, they were perfectly satisfied, you know. They could do whatever they wanted, you know. And they knew everybody. Just happy, you know. No problems or nothing. It was the people that have come in here that has put Pontiac on the move. And I don't know what would have happened to Pontiac. Well, it would have been in the same rut, because the old home guard, and even today, and I've been here 30, going on 32 years, 32 years, and I'm still a newcomer. You're the old home guard, then you're respected and everything, you know. And so it's the conditions among the white, the home guard, and the black home guard, it's good relations. But the newcomer, he's radical, you know. When you stand up for what's right, you become radical, you know. So I'm radical.
Back to your own situation. Were you born in Pittsburgh?
No, I was born in Pueblo, Colorado. Raised up in Illinois, and
how did your family get to Colorado?
My mother worked for white family. So she goes out as a nurse. And so when they get to Pueblo, then she was single at the time. She gets to Pueblo, then she marries.
Where did she come from? Where was she born?
She was born in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. But she left from Illinois, Danville, Illinois, and went out to Pueblo, Colorado. So there's three children born in Colorado, one in Kansas, and three in Illinois. Three in Illinois.
How'd your father get to Colorado?
He had worked in the wheat field. And then my dad was a real small person, and he was a racehorse trainer. So he trained horses, and that's how he got there, and working in the wheat fields. And he was originally from Tennessee. And at that time, the average person was from the South. You know, my parents, you know.
That's why it's unusual here that you were born in Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people, you know, and I never tell them unless I show them a driver's license or birth certificates, you know, they just take it for granted, you know, by me being 69, that I'm from the South, so I let them talk, and if they ask, I tell them. If they don't, I just let them wonder, you know.
Do you remember any of that experience in Colorado?
Mm-hmm. I went to school there, started in school. Yeah, I remember going to school, and remember starting in school, and where we lived in Pueblo, where we live now, it's a big steel mill. And it was quite a few Mexicans, and I used to speak Mexican. And I think it was two other black families, I can remember that. And we all talked Mexican, because that was the most that we all, that they talked. And mostly, my dad was working training horses, and he was working in the coal mine, too. And so that was the biggest thing, Mexicans, and it was cheap labor. And I remember them saying that if they made $4 a day, that was good money, you know. So I remember starting in school there, and then when we left there and went to Weir City, Kansas, went to all black school. And this was the most strangest thing, you know. Seeing all those black kids, you know, just all black, you know, no white or nothing. I've been used to seeing these Mexicans, you know, and talking that Mexican language. And so I remember that, and mother said she had time with me, saying that couldn't quite understand what they was talking about, you know. You know, American and everything. So we finally got straightened out there, and then I was 9 years old when we came to Danville, Illinois. And so I call that my home ever since 9 years old. So I was raised up there. So then I did quite a bit of traveling before I got into the union movement. I wanted to do everything else but union. But seemingly that was my the thing that I was cut out to work at, you know. So I made success at it.
How did you originally get involved in the movement?
Well, I started out as a committeeman. Well, I first started my dad, when they had strikes and so forth, I used to carry water for the guys on the strike, take food to them and everything. And I knew that system pretty well, so that became part of me. Then I just came up, you know, fighting for the principles and so forth. And everywhere I worked, I tried to organize. And I lost a lot of jobs, you know, trying to get the guys organized, get the conditions better. And that's when you working conditions were bad. And
I guess I have one other union question. What was your perception of the difference between the AFL-CIO and the CIO?
It's a great difference. It's a great difference. The AFL-CIO is very anti black, still. Still are. And it's been a few recent years. They began to make promotions, but not as they should. The CIO, Congress of Industrial Organization, I remember and participate in the organization of that. That came out of the United Mine Workers. They were fairly up to date or decent as it relates to hiring and so forth. But the union that has been good for all workers has been the UAW. They stand out in every respect. And through the UAW, taking leadership in this field has caused others to fall in line. Had it not been for the UAW, the labor movement would not accept it, the black as they have today. It was through Walter Reuther, and I say the three Reuther brothers.
In your organizing activities, did your path cross that of A. Philip Randolph?
Did what?
Did your path cross A.
Oh, yeah. Philip Randolph? Oh, yeah. Very, I had several associations with him. And he did a beautiful job for the Pullman Porters. Beautiful job. He stood up. And had it not been for him, they would have not made the gains and the progress that they did. He did a beautiful job, Philip did. And he and Walter Reuther worked very closely together. Wasn't too much they could do with George Meany. And it's hard to say, and perhaps one shouldn't say, but the only thing that will cure him is that he go and come again. That's the only thing. So he just don't see eye to eye as it relates to pigmentation of skin. Just don't see it, and he'll tell you so.
What was the relationship, again, at this point in time with the major black national organizations like the Urban League and the NAACP? What personal contact did you have with them, or what was their relationship with the whole union movement at this point?
Their relationship was good with the UAW. Wasn't too good with the FFL. And even though they put forth every effort, and it was limited, their ability to operate with them, it was limited. And they could only go so far, but they had very good cooperation with the UAW. And they did a beautiful job. Roy Wilkins, Thurgood Marshall, and many of the top organizations as Urban League, NAACP, and Philip Randolph, and so forth, had very good relationship with the UAW, and got cooperation. Many of our people worked closely with them in breaking down this barrier. I had several assignments working with them, you know, in order to break this discrimination down.
What exactly did they do? What kind of activities did they engage in?
Well, this was in like hiring. And as in Pontiac, I make an example, the Urban League here under Everett Spurlock did a beautiful job in hiring and in the getting the black girls into the bank. I sit on a committee in the A&P stores. I sit on that committee. and Urban League spearheaded that. I was president of the NAACP, worked in conjunction with them on that, plus international representative of the UAW. So we had very good cooperation. This was nationwide that we worked in this manner, wherever it was requested. Now, some areas where you had weak urban leagues, weak NAACPs, weak unions, there wasn't too much progress made. But in the areas where they were strong, it was good progress made.
Or Detroit.
Detroit had very good relationship, yeah. Very good.